Morning. Everybody's looking good and refreshed now that they've had breakfast. Some of you didn't look too good right before breakfast. Just saying. So I have the privilege of introducing our speaker this morning. We go back about 8 years or so, seems like 20, and we served together as delegates at the World Service Conference. And Tecila sat right in the front row at the conference, and I sat behind her, and my mentor sat beside me. And Tecila would turn around during the full conference while the chair or people were talking and would start saying stuff to me and talking to me. And I was, innocent, and I was, trying to pay attention and trying to watch, and listen to what was going on, take good notes, And she kept turning around, and my mentor kept saying to me, you need to stop, you're going to get in trouble. I said, I'm not doing it. She's doing it. And she would say, no, he's doing it. So if you've heard in Al-Anon that there's no Al-Anon police, right? You've heard that term before, right? Well, I'm telling you, we were on the verge of having the Al-Anon police show up and sort things out for us, right? Right there in the front row, No, but I also told her that I wasn't going to mention this one thing about her today, and until I saw all y'all, and so I said, I was noticing that a lot of people were looking at her like they knew her, and I was thinking, sometimes people, when they've been in prison, they'll recognize someone, and they're trying to put it out of their mind, And they're trying not to make that connection. So just in case you were wondering and you're that's a lingering thought in your mind as you go home, just kind of think through that one, No, but anyway, seriously, Tecila's been just such a sweet person since the first time I met her. We hit it off right away. Good person, old school. Kind of person, and real Southern kind of person, which is really cool, and always nice, good program, we really all had a good time, all her people from Tennessee and Kentucky, and we all had a good time at conference. But anyway, I introduce Tecila to y'all today. She's going to do a good job.
Okay, yeah. Good morning. I don't remember all of that quite that way. I do know that I was sitting in the front because I'm short and I wanted to be able to see what was going on. I remember that he was right there beside me and kept cracking jokes, and I'm the one that was afraid that he was going to get me in trouble. But he warned me it was going to reveal my history in prison. Let's just go on. I think that one question I had when I started into Al-Anon, when I found Al-Anon, is how did I get here? What on earth brought me here? As a child, I was not in an alcoholic family. We did not have any drinking at all that I know of ever in my family. I do remember one time my mother wanted my granddaddy to buy beer because it was some kind of a thing that would give your hair a little body. You rinse it with beer. And it was a big, huge deal. I remember it even now from my childhood because it was talked about for a week before my granddaddy went out and bought a beer. And he went to this place, and he brought it home with him, and it was like he was holding it away from him like this. Anyway, my mama used it once, and I don't think she ever had beer. He didn't go and buy her anymore. So that's the story of alcoholism in my early childhood. I was a product of a divorced family. My father was from Ecuador, and his father was from Spain, and they lived in New York City. And my grandfather pointed to a green part of the map of the United States and said, send my son to a Christian college right there. And of course, they were Catholic, and the Christian college happened to be Church of Christ, which that's like oil and water. They don't mix. And so most of my life, I was told, and I believed, that my mom and dad got divorced because of religious differences. So we'll go on from there. That was not the real reason. We went to church every Sunday morning, every Sunday night, every Wednesday night. And my church was right in the middle of Nashville. And I've spoken to a lot of you about the Ryman Auditorium, Grand Ole Opry, the original Opry House in Nashville. And my church was right across the street from the Opry. And we would go to church in the morning, and there's a parking lot, and the church and the auditorium, Ryman, was right across the street. And there would be these people laying on the street corner and in the parking lot. And I'd say, Granddaddy, what are these people doing here? And he says, oh, honey, they're just sleeping. And that's what I thought alcoholics were, was those people who slept in the parking lot after a big party or whatever. And I didn't have any reason to question that. When I went to school, they said I was a problem child, and I was. If I had been a kid today, I'm sure they would have put me in all kinds of medication. I remember being told to be quiet and be still, don't talk, quit tattling on people. By the second grade, I started getting paddling in the cloakroom. I don't know if y'all remember cloakrooms, but I get a paddling every day of the second grade. By Christmas time, the teacher was tired of paddling me, so she sent me to the principal's office, and I'd get a paddling every day. And so, you know, I really thought I was bad inside, and I've always kind of, that's something I battle with, even with my prison sentence. I'm trying to get over that. But I thought if I could be good enough, maybe my daddy would want to come and see me. I never saw him until I was 24 years old, and I went and found him. I did not know until I was in Al-Anon for about 10 years, and I don't really understand why I didn't understand this, but I was a child of an alcoholic family. I didn't know that. My father told me when I met him that the real reason that he left my mom and my little sister was because he wanted to go drinking with his friends. And I, you know, that took a lot of nerve to tell me that. And I appreciate that he was honest with me. So, but I never realized it. It just didn't dawn on me that there was anything other than that one beer for my mother's hair in my family that, you know, was alcohol related. My grandparents raised me while my mom went to work. And I think about it now, and I'm older than my grandmom was when she took us in. And mom went to work every day, and granddaddy went to work. And grandmother was raising me, and she'd already raised five children. And I came to her house as that problem child that couldn't stay still, couldn't stay quiet. And she had just lost a son in the Korean War. Well, she was grieving, and I realized that now, but it went back then. I thought I was just bad and that nobody would love me. Of course, my mom loved me, but I still had that thing about my dad and my grandparents. I wanted to please them. Granddaddy would take me fishing, and he was like my daddy. And I love him to death. But one day he took me fishing, and we caught this big old stringer of fish. Nashville's got a really good river right in the middle. And so somebody at the end of the day said, how many fish did you catch? And I picked up the stringer to show everybody, and all the fish, they slid right out of my hands. And it was not the kind you hook the fish on. They all just slid right out and got away. So my granddaddy never took me fishing again and again. I just took that as a sign that I couldn't do anything right. I wasn't loved, and I really need to try harder. So I think that people-pleasing was inbred from a very early age, And that's part of the reason I came to Al-Anon. Well, I was in so much trouble. I flunked the second grade. They said I was not ready to move forward. And so I was in second grade the second time. And my grandmother said, if you want to have friends, try being friendly. Huh? I never thought of being friendly. I just was ready to fight. I am still a fighter. My first instinct is to rear back and say something mean or just hit you if I have to. So it's what got me in prison. I'm kidding. Anyway, I started working on being friendly. How do you be friendly? She said, smile, remember people's names, ask what they like. I never thought of that. It was only, before that, what do I like? And I was too mad to smile. But it did work. And by the time I was in junior high and high school, I had become very popular. I was a cheerleader. There was a lot of my friends around. But the thing is inside of me, I didn't feel popular. I did not feel that I was worth anything. And no matter how many people were in the room or what kind of party there was, I just did not feel inside of me that I was worth having those friends. About the time I got to my senior year in high school, I had a blind date. And this guy was from a college in Nashville. They had fraternity week. And this blind date met me. Well, we were supposed to meet at the fraternity house. And his friend and my girlfriend that got me the blind date, the friend came downstairs and he says, are you such and such blind date? And I said, yeah, that's me. And he's going to be a little late because he's upstairs throwing up off the balcony. And, I didn't even think what that could mean. I just thought maybe he was a little sick. And he was, but I didn't know what kind of sickness. And anyway, he came down later, and we had a good time. And he was the life of the party. He could dance. And this was back during Motown and James Brown and all that stuff. So I was just, we had a good time. I loved him. He was fun. I didn't realize that the only time I saw him on all these dates that we had before we were married was he had already been drinking, and that's why he was so much fun. And anyway, we got married in 6 months, within 6 months after I was out of high school. He flunked out of college for the third time, and he joined the Air Force, and we moved to California. I saw my first hippies, and I took a picture and sent it to my mama. And mama, I saw hippies. And within 6 months, another 6 months, I was wearing the flower sack dresses. And I was trying, really cool, man. You're just out of sight. He went to Thailand and came back. And we lived in Wyoming for a little while. And when he got out of the Air Force, he had kind of quit drinking. He was, and I liked that because the drinking was beginning to be a problem. But I didn't realize he brought back home drugs instead. And so that began to be a problem, too. He did start drinking again. And after a while, we had our first baby. And we were living in this house that it was like on a commune. We didn't have electricity or water in our house. I went to the creek to get water and use that for cooking and bathing and all that stuff. And it was really, really kind of an experience to learn to live off the land. I don't regret that. But our house caught fire when I was cooking baking bread on a camp stove, one of those little Coleman stoves, and it ran out of gas in the middle of the bread baking, and the bread had just started to rise. I didn't want the bread to ruin. So I waited as long as I could to refill that canister with the gas, and it just went right up and burnt down my house immediately. I ran outside, and my husband was in a hammock there, and I said, oh, the house is burning down. Please come. And he looked up out of the hammock, and he said, wow, man, far out. I was pregnant at that time, and we decided that the best thing to do, since the only thing that we had were, I had a change of clothes that I had washed and put out on the clothesline, and what I was wearing, and he had the stuff that he was wearing, and we decided that the best thing to do would be to hitchhike from Nashville up to Massachusetts and find our friends, and then hitchhike down to Texas to find peyote buttons, because you could sell that, and then you could have enough money to live on. Well, did I mention that during this time I started to be a little crazy? Well, the drinking got worse. We didn't find any peyote. We didn't even know what we were doing. But we did do all this traveling around. And, oh, when I went up to New York, when we hitchhiked to Massachusetts, we went through New York. And back in those days, they had the Port Authority with big phone books around the tables, two stacks high. And I went through almost three quarters of both layers of those tables looking for my daddy's name. I thought that he lived in New York, and I found him. I took his address down and his phone number, and I wrote it down, but I was afraid to call. So anyway, after that, we came back home. I had my baby. We lived with his parents, and within a couple years, we had another baby. And actually, those were pretty good years because he wasn't drinking as much. But then it got worse after the second baby. And I realized that if he was the kind of alcoholic that could not maintain or support a family. Every time he started to do well in business, he would sabotage himself. So I realized that if I wanted to support these babies, I would have to get a job. So I went to college, and that's the first real gift that alcoholism gave me. I might not have ever gone to college if it weren't for that, because the need wasn't that great. But I went to nursing school, and I graduated as the president of my class with highest honors. And I would come home from nursing school, and my husband would say, you didn't do this right, or you didn't do that right, and you can't make biscuits, and blah, blah, blah. And even though at school I could do well and I could hold my head up, I'd come down when I'd come home to just feeling like I wasn't worth a thing. Eventually we did get a divorce. Now I want you to know that this man is a good man. He had a bad disease. And I played into all of those arguments. I didn't know it at the time. But in nursing school, in psychiatric nursing, the books there were two pages, and one was on AA and one was on Al-Anon. And I looked on that, I studied that, and it said in the Al-Anon pages that you don't have to be unhappy because he's unhappy. You can be happy whether the alcoholic is still drinking or not. And that changed my life. I had never gone to a meeting, but when I came home from school that day and he was in a bad mood, I didn't start, oh, honey, what can I do? All that stuff. I just said, okay, well, this is what we're having for dinner or whatever. I didn't let it affect me. And it worked. And so I was just that one sentence in a book. That's what carried me for the next 10 years, because I didn't come to Al-Anon at that time. We did divorce. And about 10 years later, one day my son was walking through the room. At this time, he was getting to be close to 15. And something about the way he walked and the way, it was the swagger. That alcoholic swagger? I can tell you about the alcoholic swagger. But I didn't realize that's what it was. I just looked at him and I was so mad at him that I really just would have hit him if he'd have been close enough to me. Thank goodness he wasn't. I didn't know why I felt that way, because I did not know he was drinking. And I want you to know, at that time, I was in a dual diagnosis unit for adolescents, for kids his age that had drinking and other drug problems. And I did not recognize it in my own son. What's that called? Denial? Well, I didn't want to go to an Al-Anon meeting. The Al-Anon meeting that I heard about, or, you know, at that time you looked them up on and called the center in town, and they tell you what meetings there were. But it was right in my neighborhood, and I didn't want to go there because I was afraid somebody would notice me. They see my car outside, and what if they knew there was an alcohol problem in my family? And worse, what if they thought I was the alcoholic? You know, I had so much pride. So finally, it got kind of bad, and I was brave enough to go. It was Friday, and walked in there, and the AAs were meeting down the hall, and the Al-Anons were meeting in a little room up the hall. And so I went into the Al-Anon room, and there wasn't anybody there, and I waited around for 15 minutes, and some man came in from the other room, and he said, "Well, no, this is the first time ever that nobody's been in this room." Said, "The usual, this room is packed full." So I didn't know, you know. He said, "Well, you can come over to the AA meeting. It's an open meeting, and a lot of Al-Anons find help in the AA meeting." And I couldn't do that. You know, I thought that would be like sleeping with the enemy. I found out later, you know, that wasn't the case. But when my son got his first DUI, it was 2 years later after that meeting. I took some free brochures, went home, read those brochures, and that helped me during that time. But 2 years later, my son got a DUI. And while he was in jail, I went to an Al-Anon meeting. And I sat in that meeting probably 6 months without hearing a thing because I did not want to be there. My heart was not there. My head was hard. And I just didn't think I belonged there. But, you know, because I was a nurse and I was a dual diagnosis nurse, I thought I could help you people. So I told everybody what they should do and how they could handle their problems. And, oh, it was awful. I look back on it now and I think that was just awful. When he got out of jail, I started taking him to the meetings down the hall. That way he had lost his license, and so I could drive him to the meetings, and I could pretend like I was in an Al-Anon meeting, set a good example. You know, well, here I'm going to this recovery meeting, so I know my son will follow my example. How many of your children have ever followed your example? But I went there, and I took him every meeting for 6 months, and finally my heart began to soften, and I began to hear what was in those meetings. The first thing I heard was the three C's, that I can't control it and I can't cure it, and help me, didn't cause it. Thank you. I thought at least I had caused it, if for nothing else, because I married an alcoholic and I knew that it's familial. This is a family disease. So, you know, I wanted to take on that blame. And some of the Al-Anon people helped me with that. They said, if you knew when you were pregnant that your son was going to have some kind of a genetic disease, would that have stopped you from having this baby or from loving him? And I said, well, no. And she said, well, it's the same thing with alcoholism. You know, it wasn't your fault. You can't blame yourself because somebody has a disease. Well, that helped me. So maybe I didn't cause it, but, you know, I thought maybe I could control it before I got into Al-Anon. And I started looking back on all of my plans. Not one of them had worked. I kind of liken it to when you have a bucket of water and you put your hand down in the bucket of water. When you pull it out, you know, there's no hole where your hand was. The water just seeps right back in. And that's exactly what all my control efforts were. It was like putting my hand in a bucket of water and taking it out. 2 years later, he had another DUI. The first time, it was only 30 days he was in jail, and I could kind of hide that from my church friends and from my other family members, from our neighbors. But he got a year in jail this time for not doing probation and for his DUI, second one. And I couldn't hide that one. I had to, you know, actually face it. And so by that time, I had started going to meetings. I began to understand some of the Al-Anon principles. He came home one morning after a night of drinking, and he was living with us at that time. And my first response would usually be to say, "Have you been drinking? Where'd you go last night?" I would always be mad when he got in. But something clicked in my head, and when he walked in the door that morning, I looked at him and I said, "You look tired. Would you like some breakfast?" And he just kind of did a double take because he was all stiff and ready, you know, for battle. And he said, "Well, sure." And so he was sitting in the other room waiting for me to bring him something to eat. And I could tell how bad he was. And where I could see his face from the side, I couldn't see his full face. But somehow God opened my heart and I could see for the first time what terror it must be that after you take a drink, you don't know the next thing that's going to happen to you. You don't know if you're going to wake up in jail, in a gutter. You don't know if you're going to be in somebody else's bed. You have a complete blackout. I could see the hurt and the disappointment in his face. For the first time, I realized that alcoholism is a disease. I knew it in my head that it was a disease, but not in my heart. And I imagined the terror that I would have if I go out with my friends and I'll have a beer or a glass of wine. I imagined the terror that I would have if from that moment I wouldn't know where I was going to be when I came out of it. It was painful, but I thank God that he gave me that realization. Took away a lot of the blame, a lot of the shame, that not just my guilt and blame and shame, but what I was laying on him. It changed everything in our relationship. I had been driving him around. Because I could drive him, I took him back and forth to work. I controlled what friends he would see and what friends he wouldn't see because I was picking him up and taking him there. And I took his money when he got a paycheck because I thought, if I have his money, he can't buy alcohol. You know what? He is smart. He could figure all of that stuff out, and he could still find something to drink or someone to take him somewhere. Nothing I did worked. I dropped out of Al-Anon again. It wasn't working. You know, some of those people in Al-Anon still had alcoholics they were dealing with in their homes and in their lives. So I dropped out again, and I thought, this stuff doesn't work. But I came back, and I tried something that I'd never tried before. I tried when they said, we need somebody to stand for the literature. We need somebody to go get literature. I tried that. And from the literature person, because you got to buy the literature, I became the treasurer. I'm not good with money. They just had a little blue bag, and I could take the money out for the blue bag. I never had to account for all that money in my group. But I took the money out and gave it to the literature person. I paid the rent, and whatever was left in there, I'd count it out, and that was my report. And they thanked me for that. Well, a few years rolled by, and it was his birthday, and I went to pick him up, and he looked like he had been beat up, and he said no, that he had been with some friends, and that their children started, they were throwing and catching a ball, and one of them caught the ball wrong, and he was going to roll down the embankment, and so my son fell down the hill trying to save the little kid. And I believed him. You know, they say, how do you know an alcoholic's lying? Because his mouth's open. But, you know, I wanted to believe him. How do you know an Al-Anon is gullible? Because they listen and they want to believe. We listen with our heart. And I think that that's good in a lot of respects. But it can get us into so much trouble because, you know, it's this program and God giving us understanding of the disease that helps us to love the person despite the disease. Well, he stayed in my house. It was his birthday. And he stayed with me for a week because he was so malnourished. He wasn't eating food. He was only drinking. And he was so beat up that I couldn't send him back to his place. And he was about to lose his apartment. He had lost his job. And I had talked to people and gotten him okay to go and see if the rescue mission would accept him. Well, he stayed with me for a week. And on his birthday, I asked him, what would he like for his birthday? And he wanted to stay. He said, I don't feel good enough to do anything. I just want to sit in the media room and watch movies. And I made him his favorite chicken soup. And we watched movies all day. Now, people that know me can't believe that I actually sat down and watched television because I never watch TV or watch movies. But all day I sat with him and we talked. And by this time, I had been able to tell him I was sorry for many of the control things that I had done. I'm sorry that I tried to control who you date. All of those things. And that day, he told me on his birthday, he says, Mom, I love you, and I don't blame you for that. And I was able to tell him the same, I love you. Without Al-Anon, I would have never had that experience. Because I was always too busy telling him what to do. But we had moved into this house. We built a house. It's not a big mansion. It's just a little house and in the country, kind of. And we brought my Martin house, Purple Martin house, from my old yard. Those of you who don't know what Purple Martins are, they live in those houses that look like condominiums with a whole bunch of rooms to go and live. And we put that right in front of the window where I was looking out of the media room. And on my son's birthday, when we were watching the movies, I looked out there. I was more interested in the birds than the movies. But I said, oh, look, the Purple Martins have arrived. They hadn't lived in that house the whole time we lived there for 6 years. It had been full house when we moved from the other place. But since I moved there, there hadn't been Purple Martins. And so he said, oh, yeah, birds, Mom. He thought I was a bird nerd, and I am. So anyway, God brought to my remembrance that one time before this all happened, I was looking at that Purple Martin house and just kind of off this, you know, I pray just during the day when I'm doing these different things, and I don't really think about it all the time because we just have this conversation going. And I said, and oh, by the way, God, if you ever bring me Purple Martins to this house, I'll take it as a sign that you have my son in your hands and I won't be worried anymore. Those Purple Martins came on his birthday. And so it was so comforting. Three families moved into that house. I would listen to Al-Anon speakers. I still listen to them all the time. They don't put as many Al-Anon speakers on media as they do AA speakers. So I also listen to AA speakers, and I can hear the other side of the story. And I have gained so much through AA speakers. One of the speakers said, If it weren't for AA, I would be out living on the streets. I would be dead or worse. And so I thought, what could be worse than living on the streets or dead? And then I realized he went on and spoke and he said, living with this disease of alcoholism and the place that alcoholism brings you is worse than living with the disease unrecovered. And death is worse. I'm sorry, I got it backwards. That death, that it's worse to be alive with that than to die. And so anyway, my son went home after he spent a week with me, and it was a couple of months later that I went to visit, and he had lost his apartment. He was going to have to move out, and I wanted to help him move, help him pack, and he wouldn't let me. I met him in the lobby of his apartment building, and I told him, what can I do? Nothing. I kissed him on this little forehead, and he was sitting in a chair, and I said, I'll see you in the morning, because that was his last day at his apartment. So, and also he had something that I needed to bring him, a prescription for some kind of rash or something that he had. So the next morning I went and knocked on the door, and I called him first. He didn't answer. And I went over and knocked on the door, and he didn't answer. And I began to get worried, and, kept an hour or two passed, and nothing, no answer. So I got the apartment supervisor to let me into his apartment, and I found my son there. He had died during the night. And I had heard that alcoholic, his words came back into my heart, what is worse than death and living with that disease. And so anyway, immediately people, my daughters, my family started asking me, well, are you still going to go to those meetings now that you're my son's dead? And people in Al-Anon even asked me, am I still going to continue to go to Al-Anon? And I can just tell you the reasons that I went. Because of Al-Anon, I did not have bitterness or hatred, or I was not angry with my son for his disease. Because of Al-Anon, I had found that little boy that I didn't really even realize was still there underneath that disease. I could look into his eyes and I could see the little child that I had raised, grown into a man, and his struggles. I could love him as he was without trying to change him. And he loved me back. I remembered all the times that I had apologized to him for the things, the controlling methods. I was the Nazi mama. I have four other children and a husband who's not an alcoholic, two dogs, and at that time, two cats. None of them got any attention but the alcoholic. And I was so focused on him and making him right that I made his life miserable. And I was able to put all of that aside and gain his understanding for the mistakes that I'd made. And by the time he died, there was nothing left that separated us. The disease of alcoholism itself was the only separation. We had a good relationship. So yeah, I'm going to continue to go to those meetings. And here's another reason. The next year, we got more Purple Martins. Their kids come back and they start living in the condominium next door. And then those kids have kids. By the third year afterwards, there was a terrible heat wave. I don't know if it got here in Virginia, but in Nashville, with the humidity and the heat, it got up to 114 degrees one day, and there was no rain in sight, and the baby Martins were sticking their heads out of the nest on the guardrail, just panting for breath because they were so hot. My husband said a water sprinkler that hit the top of the house to cool it off. But two of the little Purple Martin babies died. So we let the house down, and my husband took those Purple Martin babies and took them away and put the house back up. And I watched that Martin family whole. And the Martin mama and daddy, they both look the same, a lot the same. They came back to that Purple Martin hole with food in their mouth. They particularly like to feed their children dragonflies. So you can see the wings and all this stuff. And they took that dragonfly into the little hole, and they both went in. Both of them had a dragonfly and stayed for a minute or two. And they came out and they went next door and they fed the little babies in the condominium next door. So what did that teach me? You know, God didn't single me out to lose my son. Even Purple Martin lose their children. And what do the parents do? They go into their little place and they collect themselves and they come back out and they try to be of help and feed the babies next door. So why do I come to these meetings? When my son died, I was grieving. I'm still grieving. It's been 11 years now. That doesn't go away. But when my son died, I was able to follow the example of those Martins, and I can come back to these meetings and gain strength and take that to my babies, which aren't babies at all, but the newcomers and the people that are grieving in this program. I wouldn't have had that. I wouldn't have had the opportunity to stand in front of you without that. Because of Al-Anon, I've gone places in this world that I would have never had the chance. In service, I learned how to do so many things that I would have been afraid to try without Al-Anon. I could be a secretary now. I could do a lot of really good things. But I want to serve. I want to share the love that I found in this program. I don't think that alcoholics are out there and that they're worse than we are because they're drinking. I don't think that alcoholics who have found AA are better than alcoholics who are not recovered and are not drinking and or not drinking. Recovery and not drinking are two different things. I think that the way that God looks on us all is that he looks down and we've all got our faults. And some of our faults are different than others. But when you're looking down say you got a stack of dimes or quarters, and you look down on those two stacks of them, you can't tell from that perspective which one's the higher one. Well, God's perspective is that much more high. And each one of us have our own flaws, and none of us are better than the other. We're all equal in God's eyes. Whether we're recovered in Al-Anon, recovered in AA, or still out there in the streets. When I didn't belong, you people took me in and welcomed me. When I made mistakes in service, you people thanked me for my service. When I was in desperate grief and mourning, you people loved me. And if nothing else, that's what I want to share. And I hope that you can share that with the people that you're around. And that's my story.